like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today's show is A.J. Sanjar, a biologist who's part of a team conducting research with significant implications for reducing the population of the Burmese python. There are several efforts underway seeking to mitigate the expanding python populace. A huge and growing number of these often massive snakes with few natural predators, making them an apex invasive species in areas like the Florida Everglades. Over the years, these efforts have ranged from python hunters, professional trappers, and hobbyists who simply track and kill the snakes, to scientists who employed radio tags on male pythons using the so-called scout snakes to lead and remove breeding females, while still others have deployed robotic bunnies with GPS devices to lead hunters to the snakes. We're a little over a month away from the annual Florida Python Challenge, a competition wherein contestants capture and kill pythons for prize money following strict guidelines. Perhaps as good a time as any to explore the science-based technique that Sanjar is pursuing. It's also an opossum-based technique, which is to say, this research involves Sanjar and his colleagues using GPS-collared opossums to locate the pythons. The team can follow the signals when an opossum is swallowed whole by a python, leading team members or others to the location of these massive snakes, which can then be removed. Opossums are considered abundant in the area and serve as a prime food source for pythons. It would appear the chief objective of this research is to eliminate massive breeding females to seriously stem the growth of the python population, but we'll investigate that question and others when I speak with A.J. Sanjar here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. A programming note at the moment, though, is in exactly 1 week, on June 3rd, WMNF Summer Fun Drive begins, and I'll be raising money on Talking Animals on that very day, Wednesday, June 3rd, and I'm asking for your help. I'm typically assigned a huge fundraising goal, especially for a one-hour show, and this drive seems to be no exception, maybe my biggest goal ever. So I've learned over the years that the only real prospect of reaching a giant goal is to receive pledges before the fun drive show. For example, how about donating today? Just a suggestion. So I'm hoping you might consider donating before June 3rd, any amount that you can swing, $35, $50, if you can go up to $100 or more. Some people occasionally do $200 or $300, that's great. Anything would be greatly appreciated. The thing to keep in mind is with Trump stripping away funding for public broadcasting, success in these fund drives has become even more crucial than ever. And as always, I'll be offering some exclusive Talking Animals thank you gifts for pledges at various levels, ranging from a pair of tickets to the, almost sold out now, Joe Jackson concert July 2nd at the Capitol Theater. Cat wind chimes that are as beautiful sounding as they are in their appearance, a beautiful tumbler decorated with the message, yes, I really do need all these animals, special hair, pet hair removal glove, and other things as well. So we just hope, whether you want a gift or not, that you'll visit WNF.org, and in the upper right-hand corner, click on Donate Now, and just follow the prompts. Eventually, you'll come to a drop-down menu, which says Designate to pick a show, and just please select TLA, Talking Animals, so that our show is credited with your donation. If you enjoy the work and you appreciate some of our shows over the years, it would be great to support us now in that way. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's program, we'll hear an extended comedy piece that includes a section about opossums. We'll also hear a tune probably called Burmese Python. One or more of these coming up later on today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with A.J. Sanjar about opossums, pythons, where that twain may meet. With a reminder, I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome A.J. Sanjar, the Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, A.J.
Good morning, Duncan. It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, of course, we'll explore the world of opossums and pythons in a moment. So that's kind of our focus ultimately, of course. But first, let's learn about you, your background, your path to becoming a scientist, and so on. So I believe you grew up in Austin, Texas. What kind of a kid were you then?
I was a pretty active kid. I loved going outside, running in the woods. I was a big soccer player. I loved pretty much anything that got me outside and in the sun. And
in Texas. Were you into wilderness and animals at that point as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. I've been into wildlife my whole life. And yeah, in Texas, we were fortunate. There's a lot of natural springs around where I grew up. So I used to go to the springs a lot, flip rocks, go swimming and snorkeling and looking for all like the little critters that like to hang around the water. And yeah, growing up, I always, my favorite channel to go to was like Animal Planet or Discovery Channel. So I was big into wildlife ever since I've been a little kid.
That's great. Makes sense. Yeah, it's a beautiful area for that for sure. And at what point did science in particular first fascinate you?
So I probably didn't really get into science until I was later on. Even in my early years out of high school, I was actually planning on being a firefighter. And then I did some firefighter courses, some EMT courses, and decided it just wasn't for me. And then,
I'm just curious before we move too far beyond that, what kind of drew you initially to being a firefighter? Was there something in particular, an incident, or did you see something or read something, or what?
I don't think there was a particular incident that drew me to it. I do know when I was a little kid, I used to tag along with my sister and my mom for her Girl Scout trips. And they did a trip to the fire station one time. And I, even though I wasn't a Girl Scout, I was just a little brother joining. I had the most questions for all the firefighters. So I think just as a little kid, I was drawn to that type of work and doing something with my body, helping people out. It just caught my eye, but it wasn't what I ended up pursuing, but
yeah.
And science in a way is kind of similar. Like we're outside in the field working with our body a lot when we're working with wildlife that in a way helps another living creature and helps the world as a whole. And that's something I'm passionate about.
For sure. So when did you say that science really started to sort of post-fireman phase, et cetera? When did that really start to get a grip on you and see some of you thought maybe I should really pursue this more seriously?
Well, my brother actually, my older brother, he's also a wildlife biologist as well. And when I was deciding to switch away from firefighting, I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do. And I honestly didn't even know that, like, being a wildlife biologist was like a easily obtainable like job to get. And then I started talking to my brother more and he's like, oh, like you should apply for Texas State. They have a great wildlife program and you love wildlife. So yeah, it could be a good fit. And I didn't know what I was going to do. So I figured I like animals, might as well see what it's all about.
It's really an open suggestion, it sounds like, but thank God for your sort of the guidance and tutelage of your brother. Sounds like falling right in his footsteps directly. Just out of curiosity, is he still a wildlife biologist, or what does he do at this point?
He still is, and he actually just started working in Cumberland Island in Georgia, so he's excited for his next job there. He works with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Where did with the path that he kind of set up and suggested? So I take it he went into that college program then that he had suggested, or trace the steps here.
Yeah, so I started the wildlife program at Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas, and with that I was able to do some interesting classes, and I got to do a study abroad. Based in Ecuador, and that was my first time like getting to see like actual field work first person. And
what was that project in Ecuador?
So that one was working with different frog species down there. The professor I was with was doing a genetics analysis to see if as you gained an elevation, if these specific species of frogs speciated at all as you gained elevation, so we became different species with the elevation. So that job or that class, We would just go hike in the rainforest and catch as many frogs as we can and do genetic analysis after we caught them all. And yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, I
Right, and
loved
not
it.
to get too sidetracked. So the species actually shifted as the altitude shifted. Is that what this was exploring?
Yeah, that's the main question they were exploring with that. Yeah, just to see, because there's
And what was
as
the
you
answer? Did they?
know, slightly at the extreme elevations, but it wasn't as stark of a difference as some people were expecting. But once you got to the higher altitude mountaintops, they started to speciate a little bit more.
Wow, because that seems really fascinating. It's almost like where science meets science fiction in a way, like the transformation of a species, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So post Ecuador, then what happened there? What was your next field?
Post Ecuador, I actually got my first paid job with the professor I went to Ecuador with, and I was working on a snake fungal disease project in Texas, working with the Concho water snake, which is an endemic snake to the Concho River. It's just a cute little water snake, and we would go out in the field for a couple weeks at a time, collect as many snakes as possible, and we would swab them, trying to test for snake fungal disease and seeing if it affected this Concho water snake at all. And we would also test any other snake that we captured as well. So just really doing a big snake fungal disease assessment of that river.
Is that fungal element there kind of particular to that Contra River there, or?
It's found in other rivers as well, but since that Concho water snake is only found in that river and it has a very small population number, they were wanting to see the effects of that fungal disease on that specific species of snake. But it is found in other rivers throughout the country.
Well, this is cool. This sounds like a very cool program there at Texas State, right? Because it sounds like already there's two or three really intriguing things you'd already done just as an undergrad, correct?
This snake fungal disease, yes, started my senior year of my undergrad, and then I did it a little bit after I graduated as well.
I got you. Let me know, folks, who might have just tuned in a bit late to join us. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is AJ Sanjar, a biologist who's part of a team conducting research with significant implications for reducing the Burmese python population. Specifically, Sanjar and his colleagues use GPS collared possums to locate the pythons, which then can be removed. If you'd like to ask AJ a question about this research or offer a comment, or in the research he's already mentioned, of course, we probably field questions about that as well. Please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So the snake study, et cetera, kind of carried rolled from senior year into post. Then did you immediately go into graduate school after that, or?
No, I did a few years working different field tech positions. So after that snake fungal disease job, I also worked in a lab at Texas State for a little bit doing a lab-based study on the snake fungal disease. And with that, then I went and worked in Nevada for a little bit on a desert tortoise position. And with that position, I was just like walking the Mojave Desert, doing population surveys on the tortoise population there. So that was a real fun job, just getting to hike the desert and count tortoises all day. I
Yeah,
loved it. Yeah.
that sounds great. So yeah, a lot of again very interesting experiences leading up to kind of where we'll end up focusing our conversation today. It sounds like there's been some really interesting things. So what was the tortoise population? Was it shifting in significant ways when you did that study?
It was unfortunately the tortoise population isn't doing as well as it hopefully would be.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of invasive grasses that affect their population negatively that they just didn't evolve to eat those type of grasses, and it impacts in their mouth and makes it harder for them to eat other foods. And of course, with human expansion and development, they're losing habitat. So, yeah, unfortunately, the we didn't find as many tortoises as we were hoping to find.
Yeah,
But
that's too bad when you're trying to look at the population. The population looks like it's already dwindled, I guess.
yeah.
So let me ask you this, just overall, before we move on too much other, like grad school and stuff. While you're in those college years, like again, you've done did some great field study and went to some cool places, including Ecuador. Did anything otherwise along the way, kind of early in your college career, sort of constitute a distraction or detour? Because it sounds like otherwise you've been pretty much on a path of doing the field research opportunities that you either found or explored or somebody recommended. But was there something altogether unrelated that for a while had your interest, or were you kind of peeled off that path for a time?
Not really. Ever since I started my biology courses, it's been my primary focus career-wise and school-wise. I didn't really
And it
take
sounds like
any.
it was as exciting and interesting as you had hoped it would be, and so you just kind of kept going, it sounded like.
Oh, definitely, yeah. In some ways, it was more exciting than I was expecting because, like, I never expected to go to Ecuador, like walk the Mojave Deserts, like miles from any other person. And once I got out and started doing the field work, I was like, oh, this is more than I was hoping for. I gotta see where this takes me and keep pursuing this path.
That's great. Well, I assume you've thanked your brother profusely for that initial recommendation.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, how did you wind up going to, if I'm not mistaken, you did your graduate work at Southern Illinois University? What drew you there?
So actually, to get that graduate position, I first started working here in Key Largo as just a field technician, and I was working on a master's student's project that was being conducted here, who was attending Southern Illinois University, Kelly Crandall, who
Okay, I
I
was going to
think he,
ask if it was Kelly Crandall because yeah,
yeah, I was
she was a
gonna.
guest on the show.
Yeah, and I remember her talking about it. But yeah, I was a technician on her project when you interviewed her, actually. And through that position, her advisor and Jeremy, the refuge manager here at Crocodile Lake, both liked my work ethic and just who I was as a person. So they recommended me as a master's student at SIU to continue on the field work down here in Key Largo. And with Kelly's project, her project was studying the home ranges of meso mammals here in Key Largo, specifically Crocodile Lake National Wildlife Refuge. And some of her mammals got eaten, which like helped inspire this project that I was able to work on for my master's using the possums with radio collars.
Yeah, I mean, say again more specifically what her study was, because it was, I think, if I recall from talking to her, there was this almost sort of inadvertent results that were significant.
So Kelly Crandall's project was she was radio collaring raccoons and possums and studying their home ranges and seeing if the feral cat population, if they transferred any of the toxoplasmosis parasite to the meso mammals that are native here. And she was investigating if that parasite toxo was affecting their behavior at all and affecting their home ranges at all. And while she had these collared animals out in their habitat, a couple of them ended up getting eaten by pythons. And the technicians at the time were able to catch those pythons and remove them. And it got everyone thinking, hey, we might be onto something bigger here. This might be a good way to remove pythons that we haven't tried before. And
And how
yeah.
often does that happen in your experience in research, field research, or the midst of some researching something else, something kind of spins you in a surprising way into a different direction that you didn't anticipate?
I would say a decent amount of times something unexpected will happen and kind of inspire a new project or take this project down a new path. So it's not the most common thing, but it's definitely not unheard of.
Yeah.
So it, yeah.
So once you, that surprise and that realization happened, tell us, take us kind of from that part of the story forward.
Yeah, so after they caught those first few pythons with at least colored mammals. They wanted to pursue this further, and they thought it'd be a perfect master student project. And so they asked me if I wanted to do it. And I mean, you don't turn down a master's that's offered to you like that. So I said yes, of course. And then started all the training, started coloring possums, getting ready to go to SIU. And with that, I ended up doing half my time here in Key Largo and half my time in Carbondale, Illinois. So I was in classes sometimes. I'd come back here, do a lot of field work, go back to Carbondale and be in touch with my technicians while they're all working here. Yeah, it was a pretty cool process. It was the first time I ever like led a project and was in charge of technicians. So it was a lot of fun and a new opportunity for me that I enjoyed a lot.
So, looking back, was this kind of, in a sense, taking over and spinning off Kelly Crandall's project, or do you think of it as more like starting a new one, just spurred by what she had discovered with hers inadvertently?
Yeah, I would say it was a little bit of a spin-off of her project. We definitely didn't look into the home ranges at all. We were more focused on the management implications and then the survival rates of possums. So we did, with my project, we did a very thorough survival analysis of the possums. And with Kelly's, they didn't do that survival analysis. So with mine, we were able, for my analysis, we were able to collar about 135 individual possums. And then we were able to determine different mortality rates for all the different mortalities these animals experience in their lives. So we were able to find out about 20% of the possums we collared were killed by pythons.
And what seemed to dictate ones that were would become victims of pythons? Was that partly their size, or were there other factors as well that played into it, or?
From what we could tell, I mean, we only collared adult possums, so they all were roughly the same size, probably give or take about 1 kilogram or 2 pounds from each other. And we did notice there was more males that were consumed than females, but we also just had more males included in the project. They tend to be a little bit more trap happy than the females, and they also have larger home ranges than the females, so they might run into these pythons more often since they tend to be more of ambush predators. They won't go out hunting as much as wait for the prey to come to them. So I think these
Interesting.
males tend to get picked off a little bit more often than the females that have smaller ranges and aren't moving around as much.
Yeah, because ultimately it seems like what you're really interested in terms of the research or in terms of the making a difference to the python population is actually the females, right? So it's almost like kind of, a bit of an ironic twist that that's what was more what you were finding were the males.
Of the
opossums, and then that seems like that's what was turning up in the traps. But
Yeah, definitely.
so again, with notable surprises, do I remember correctly? There was a bit of a surprise that when the possums ended up in the traps, the GPS kept transmitting, where I think some may have thought or assumed that that wouldn't necessarily be the case.
So with my collars, we didn't have GPS collars. They were only VHF. So
Okay.
we could track them with an antenna, but we didn't get those GPS points. Since Kelly's was trying to get the home range and we didn't need the home range analysis, these collars were significantly cheaper than the GPS collars. Mine are about $200 and Kelly's were, I want to say like $1,400. I
Oh my
don't remember
goodness. Wow.
exactly, but it was a massive difference that really affected how many collars we would be able to buy.
Right.
And we were, since these VHF collars provide everything we need and we can still get a signal from inside a python after it's eaten, we figured this was the better option. And the batteries last a lot longer when you don't have to worry about the GPS capabilities.
Yeah, maybe what I was remembering was maybe it was still the tail end of of Kelly's research, because I thought there was some surprising element that the callers still continued to transmit once the possum had been consumed by the by the python. But I guess that was probably more hers than yours, it sounds like, based on the difference in the callers.
Yeah, that was definitely more her side.
So is the focus here then, was it locating ultimately female pythons? Where did the research, where did your focus go once you shifted over from what Kelly had been doing and obviously had different kinds of callers? What were the objectives specifically at that point in your initial research there?
So for my research, my main objectives were figuring out or conducting a very thorough survival analysis on the possums.
Okay.
And then trying to capture and remove as many pythons. And we didn't really have a preference for male or females per se. Getting the big breeding females is always a great target to get. But fortunately with this method, since they are adult possums with collars, the python has to be of a certain size to be able to eat them. So pretty much every python we've captured with this method has been over 8 feet, which generally leads to getting more pythons in that breeding range and removing the big breeders from the environment. And this helps us also target pythons that are like further away from the roads that you typically don't see. Because one of the main ways to catch pythons down here is just road cruising, just driving the roads and hoping you happen to encounter a python.
Yeah.
So it's really targeted those big breeders that hang away from the roads.
And do female pythons hang out in areas that are largely the same or somewhat different from where male pythons hang out?
Here in Key Largo, we haven't really noticed difference in habitat preference between the male and the females. The females will have like specific habitats they like to lay their nests in. But we've only ever actually found one nest here in Crocodile Lake or in Key Largo. And it happened to be in a supplemental wood rat nest, but there's still a lot of unknowns of what the pythons are doing here. We have, since Key Largo is built on an old fossilized coral reef, there's a lot of underground habitat that they like to use, which is part of the reason why this method was so helpful, because the scout pythons, which I believe you mentioned earlier, we did try that here in Key Largo, and it wasn't effective because when we go to track that python that had the transmitter in it, it would always be underground, and any associated pythons with it would just run away if we made too much noise trying to dig them up.
They would send the signal where the python was, but it was so kind of obscure or remote that you couldn't really do anything to follow up on that particular python.
Yeah, and we would only be able to track our scout python, and the goal of the scouts is to catch all the associated pythons that are hanging around that scout. But since those associated pythons didn't have a transmitter on them, they would just disappear underground farther and we'd never be able to track them. But with this method, that individual python will swallow the transmitter, the radio collar, and we'll be able to track that individual until it's captured. So less pythons getting missed and escaped.
So tell me, this began because it was an opportunity for a master's thesis or a project, maybe more precisely, built around this very research. So at this point in the game, what does it mean? What does your project show? And where do we go from here, I guess, is the other question.
So I've actually already, completed my master's and defended my thesis this past December.
Right.
Hopefully going forward with this, we're still currently using the method here at Croc Lake, and I think it'll be a method we kind of continue to use indefinitely now, and hopefully it can also be adapted to other areas. I think it's kind of perfect for Croc Lake because we have a very small habitat size. It's a tiny little skinny island, so there's not too many places they can get away. We can kind of hear most of our radio callers from the road, But I believe this could be very helpful in other parts of South Florida. So hopefully, other researchers will try and adapt this in their or adopt this in their areas. And I know some of those areas also don't have the same possum numbers as Key Largo does because they've had pythons much longer, and pythons have drastically lowered mesomammal numbers where their strongholds are. But yeah, I hope one day they'll be able to use this in the Everglades and Big Cypress and be able to remove those big breeders that are kind of just escaping capture right now.
Yeah. So you finished your master's on this exact research in December, but
Yes.
am I right in thinking that you continue to still carry on the research in some version or?
So I'm still currently working at Croc Lake as a contractor with the North Carolina Museum of Science, and
Specifically with the idea of extending the research further than what you did for your master's?
So we're as of right now, like this is about to be or beginning of the busy time for our possum project. Normally in May, they start eating, the pythons start eating. And so right now we're catching as many possums as we can. We're putting as many collars out in the environment as we're able to. And every week we're going and getting visuals on the possums, making sure they're still alive and not inside a python, and just trying to get as many out there as possible. And every year we kind of refine the project a little bit, change like some timelines, and get it as efficient as possible. So if other researchers do want to adopt this, we'll have a solid plan that they can follow, and make it as easy as possible for other people who want to recreate it.
And I might have misunderstood this, but are you saying that pythons, obviously there's seasonal elements to their breeding, but are you saying there's seasonal elements to their eating as well?
From my research, I was able to see, at least here in Key Largo, we didn't have a single possum mortality from a python between December and May. And then once it gets to May, they start feeding and pretty heavily until about September, November. That's when they slow down again. September, they're eating a lot. November, it kind of slows down, but we'll get like one or two mortality events in those later fall months. But yeah, their majority of their feeding, if not all of it, is primarily done in like the warmer summer months, partially due to the breeding season. They like to eat after they've had their breeding season, and they also the warmer months help with their digestion as well.
But if I follow you, the eating kind of season, as it were, affects both males and females. So in terms of the breeding, there's less impact, I would think, on the males, yet they still have that same kind of timetable loosely, it appears.
Because they'll stop feeding when they're looking for mates. And so the males will go off searching for females, and the females will kind of wait and let the males come to them. So they'll both kind of stop feeding in that time.
So
Of
in
course,
that
there are some exceptions, but primarily, yeah, they won't be eating as much.
So does that mean kind of in that December May period that they're also just a lot less active as far as moving around and covering more terrain?
Some individuals will be more active because they're actively looking for a mate. So you might, they'll still be moving around a bit. They just won't be looking for food as much.
I mean, I think that as a secondary thing, I think that's really interesting that there's that much of a variance for that many months in their eating habits.
I think it helps in a way, those habits that we can use this radio-collared possum method in tandem with, say, the scout python method. And I kind of focus the scout pythons during more of those breeding months, and then focus on the radio-collared possum in more of these feeding months. So you can kind of get them from both sides, you know?
Yeah, so you sort of take advantage of the seasonal element to it. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with AJ Sanjar, a biologist who's part of a team conducting research with, as we're hearing, significant implications for reducing the population of invasive Burmese pythons. It involves, as we've also heard, of course, possums fitted with collars. So you're invited to join the conversation. If you have any questions for AJ about his research or about, well, pythons and or possums, really, I guess, you could call 813-239-9663. You could email DJ at WNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So is the idea, it sounds like, is to kind of keep sort of extrapolating the core research that you did for your master's and further research just generally, but also geographically. It sounds like the idea would be, whether or not you oversee it, the idea is taking this kind of research into other areas of Florida.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think it would be helpful in areas that is kind of on like the invasion front of the Burmese python spread, if you will, because it is very helpful at finding pythons when they have low population numbers, or if you're unsure if pythons are there. If you have a group of radio collared possums in the environment and there are pythons that are present, there is a pretty high chance at least one of your possums will get eaten, and you'll be able to definitely say, yes, there's pythons here, and maybe that'll bring more funding in to help fight that invasive if it was unknown previously.
Interesting. So there's a lot of sub questions, as there would be, I guess, in most research projects that are raised or that get raised after the core research is complete.
Definitely.
So let me ask you this. You're a scientist, not an animal welfare, you know, advocate. Still, I'm interested to know if you or your colleagues ever feel conflicted at all by conducting research that involves one animal dying along the way, the possum, obviously, and another animal, the python, being killed as sort of the upshot of the research.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I obviously don't love euthanizing pythons. I would say that is my least favorite part of the job. I think they're beautiful animals, and I wish they were natives because they are very cool creatures. But unfortunately, they cause a lot of damage to the Florida ecosystem,
Let me stop you there if I could, AJ, just because, I mean, we've talked a lot about this kind of issue on the show many times, but for people listening who may not know what the impact of the pythons is on other animals and just the general environment, maybe you could sort of outline what the pythons do and what the impact of being an invasive species in this area is.
Yeah, so the pythons have drastically lowered a lot of mammal and bird species population numbers, like significantly. In the Everglades, there's a study that saw both raccoons and possums, their numbers dropped by 98 or 99% of what they were in the early 2000s and 90s. So they're having massive impacts on these mammal populations. And
what specific mammals dropped 98%? That's staggering.
I believe, if I remember the numbers correctly, I want to say possums dropped like 98.7%, and then raccoons were just right around that. Maybe they were 99.3. They were both in that range of like 98 to 99%. I don't remember the percentages off the top of my head right now.
Yeah,
but
no, I just was curious. Just generally, that's such a huge percentage drop that, I mean, I knew they had tremendous impact. I guess I didn't realize it was that dramatic with some species.
Yeah, and definitely in certain areas. That was, like, primarily done on Main Park Road in Everglades National Park. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you go into the Everglades National Park and you see a raccoon or a possum, that's a pretty lucky day because there's not many of them left anymore. And they're also affecting other reptiles. They brought in different parasites and, like, respiratory illnesses that spread through our native snake population and really took a number on them just through diseases alone. And then competition with food, because they eat a lot of rodents as well, a lot of small mammals, a lot of birds, which happens to be food for other native predators that we already have here.
Yeah. If I actually were sort of take a couple of steps back for big picture, with all the different efforts, your research, but there's been so many different kinds of efforts, including the competition that happens every year, whatever, to try to reduce the python population. What would you say are the prospects of it being, or is there just too many pythons and too many ways that they reproduce and too few? Because they really don't have any actual enemies or predators, typically, if I'm not mistaken. So What are the prospects of really reducing that population significantly, or is it just up against too many factors that the pythons kind of have in their favor that in that regard?
Yes, the pythons definitely have a lot of things helping them in a way. Like the Everglades is a massive wildlife area, so it'd be very hard to get people out there catching snakes in the middle of nowhere. And there are a lot of methods that we are using to remove pythons, and there's a lot of new innovative things that are being developed. I think, I think there might be pythons kind of for good, and our best efforts are now just to manage the population and not remove them.
Yeah.
If there is some way to develop some sort of biological way of controlling them, say, like how they sterilize like certain mosquitoes and release them, something along that sorts, or some sort of species-specific targeted illness. But those can be tricky and have unforeseen consequences. So I can definitely see why something like that hasn't been developed yet. But it is going to be very hard to make a significant impact on their numbers. And hopefully the best, hopefully we can contain them where they are and stop them from spreading. But yeah, it's an uphill battle for sure.
And from starting off kind of mostly in South Florida, I want to think I had a conversation on this show with one of our folks that were talking about their kind of expansion into other areas in northern Florida and or maybe even Georgia. Is that possible? I might be misremembering that part.
I haven't heard of any wild ones in Georgia. I'm sure there would be like anecdotal released pets or things like of that nature. Yeah. But some of those areas might get too cold for them. There is concerns of certain areas of them being able to hunker down, maybe underground, and survive the colder months. But as of right now, I don't think those northern areas are a major threat from pythons.
Okay, that's good to know. So, So basically, it sounds like you and others that have done this kind of research or know this kind of situation very closely are thinking, hey, if we can just hold the population steady, that'll be a pretty big achievement. But the idea of actually reducing the population just is probably unlikely to happen.
Yeah, without any new methods of removing them, I think lowering their numbers will be difficult.
Are there other technological or other methods that you're aware of that are, you know, sort of being experimented with or tested out at the moment that we haven't heard about yet?
I know there's always a bunch of different things that people are trying to develop. I think one that's been talked about a little bit is the robot rabbits.
Yeah.
Using them to try and lure pythons in. I haven't heard how successful that's been yet, but any new method is exciting. I think it doesn't hurt to try something new. The only thing you can learn is this one doesn't work, let's try something else. But yeah, I haven't heard anything recently of some new crazy ideas, but I would love to hear some. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes peeled for any kind of developments on that. One last thing, we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, AJ, but is there a website or somewhere where people listening could go for some of the results or specifics of the research that we have discussed here today?
So I don't believe there's a website that I know of that has talked about these results.
Okay.
I am in the process of publishing some of the results from my thesis, so hopefully soon I'll have a published copy or a scientific paper out with the results from the management and the survival side of my thesis. I do already have the thesis out, but nobody wants to read a thesis. but yeah, we unfortunately don't have a website to go to look at these results.
But
yeah,
at some point, something like maybe there'd be like an abstract or something that would kind of take what your thesis presents and
yeah, there'll be a more
digestible,
easily obtainable, digestible results of my thesis soon,
so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds good. We'll kind of keep an eye out for that. And if that does happen, hopefully you can keep us posted so we can be sure to mention that on the show for people who might be interested in finding out more. Because I think there's a lot of people who are interested in this whole world of the Burmese python population and
what
if anything affects it, and especially what might reduce it. So AJ, we have reached the end of our time here. We've been speaking with AJ Sanjar. And thank you, AJ, for making the time to speak with us on Talking Animals. And good luck with your ongoing research and whatever else may be next. Sounds like you've already had some great projects just from the day your brother said, hey, maybe you should check this out. And so there's probably more to come, I would guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was happy to speak with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again. In a moment, we'll hear that extended comedy piece that has a section on opossums, and we also want to hear a tune actually called Burmese Python, if we play our cards right. All relevant, of course, to today's show. So, in fact, we're going to step into the comedy corner with Dusty Slay with a piece called Trailer Park Pets that includes this section on opossums in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I feel like parents are a lot different today than they were when I was growing up, like, especially when it comes to pets, right? Because nowadays you might hear some parent be like, we got to take our cat to the vet, right? But when I was growing up, my dad would be like, we don't have a cat anymore. And then we didn't, you know? He couldn't even get mad about it. I'd just be like, well, I hope we get another one. He's like, well, we'll see what wanders up. Because we didn't have real pets. We just had prisoners of nature. Like a dog would wander up, we'd chain him to a tree. Now he's ours. That's why we didn't believe in the Easter Bunny, right? We knew if a bunny came to our house, we'd lock him up. Lock him up. We had the meanest cat you ever seen for about 2 weeks. Found out it was a possum, and possums are scary. I don't know if you've seen them before. If I see a possum in my backyard, I just go inside. I don't come out for 2 weeks. Can't do it. Can't do it. You ever go to somebody's house and they got a dog that's barking at you, growling at you, and they go, oh, he won't bite. It's like, why do you think that? Because he's never done it before? Well, maybe today is the day. Because he looks like he wants to bite. They always go, well, he might lick you to death. I'm like, death? Who said anything about dying? I'm just worried about being bitten. I don't even know why you brought up death. I just think it's a weird idea, right? Because a dog looks like it wants to bite you. It's like you show up at somebody's house and there's a guy in there with a knife. He's just doing like this. And they're like, oh, he won't stab you. He might lick it again. Hey, he'll settle down in a minute. He just not used to being around people. Let him sniff you. Stephia. What a great time that is. I used to be a big drinker when I worked in restaurants. Everybody knows about that. And I quit drinking because I used to black out all the time, you know? Nothing good ever happens when you black out, right? No one's ever like, man, you blacked out last night, but I appreciate you helping with those taxes. A lot of money back. All right, hey, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
That was Dusty Slay in today's Comedy Corner. The piece called Trailer Park Pets, taken from his album Son of a Ditch. So in the background, we're going to continue now with the promised Burmese Python song, since it happens to be an instrumental. And you don't get to hear a Burmese Python song every day. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up on WMNF, It's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mauro Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back into music programming with Sam Wall, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., and more great stuff happening throughout the day and evening on 88.5 WMNF. Reminder that the Summer Fun Drive starts next Wednesday, a week from today, June 3rd. I'll be here raising money for WNF, joined by the fabulous Flea. Please help us get a jump on our giant fundraising goal with an early pledge in support of Talk Animals. Again, visit WMNF.org, click on Donate Now, and just follow the prompts. Please designate your donation to TLA, Talking Animals. And among our exclusive gifts, we have all kinds of cool trinkets and animal-related things, of course, and a pair of tickets to Joe Jackson at the Capitol Theater. So hope to hear from you then in support of the show. Also invite you to visit TalkAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever archives of every show are on TalkAnimals.net. Apple Podcasts are available too, as well as other podcast platforms. Also links to our social media pages. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our DS a couple of days beforehand. And other news from the Talking Animals world, that's on TalkAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind animals. Be kind others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Wikiwachi, and beyond. Again, my thanks to AJ Sanjar for a cool conversation and sort of the portrait of a young scientist in a way, among other, many other things. So, again, we'll be back next Wednesday. Hoping to hear from you with the support of Talking Animals and WNF on the Fun Drive. It's Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Stay tuned. Thanks.